You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
All right, you ready for some more Daniel? That guy on the right there, that's Nebuchadnezzar, the dude we're going to be talking about today. The people approaching him on the left there, those are his advisors attending to him, who we'll also be talking about. This whole story we're going to get into really focuses on how God deals with a rebel. And you guys know about rebels. A lot of you are parents. You know, your kids are cute, but they're little rebels. They'll do things when you're not watching. I was just talking to my buddy. He's got I think she's 2 years old, maybe three. She was taking a bath. He stepped out for a minute. She starts scooping water in a cup and pouring it onto the floor over and over. He had to run downstairs. He's seeing water rolling down into the basement. Rebel. Yeah, and you say, we're all familiar with this tension where we deeply love people, but then they do things that we need to address, okay? And this is God's situation on a much more extreme, a much larger scale. He's perfect, we're not. And from day one, with the very first human beings, Adam and Eve, they rebelled against him. And since then, every human that's ever lived has had a built-in heart of rebellion. And of course, way back, God could have cruised in. He could have cruised in and just said, I can tell this is just going to go south. Let's just snuff out humanity. But that's not how God operates. God deeply loves us. And so instead of snuffing us out, he sent his son on a rescue mission to endure the just punishment for what we've done wrong in our place. That's really the whole story of the Bible, is about God going across the universe, you know, reaching right into our world so that he can rescue rebellious people who have turned away from him. And this whole story is about how God does that with Nebuchadnezzar. And I think that, just so I don't lose you, the big headline here is, even as we rebel, God will always pursue us. And we totally see that in this account. So it starts out in the second year of his reign. Nebuchadnezzar, that's the king of Babylon, he had dreams. His mind was troubled and he couldn't sleep. So the king summoned magicians, enchanters, sorcerers, and astrologers, his advisors, to tell him what he had dreamed. Okay, so for us, you know, we have a nightmare dream. We forget about it after a while. Not a big deal. Back then, bad dreams were a huge deal. They had these dream records. Archaeologists have dug these up, where they have the dreams that royalty have dreamt correlated with past events. So it might be this kind of dream correlates with famine, or this correlates with a good harvest, or military victory, or military defeat. And so it was a big deal, even though the Nebuchadnezzar, he's on top of the largest empire in the world, but when he gets a dream like this, that really knocks him off balance, because it could be really bad news. And it was so rough, so disturbing, it says he couldn't fall back asleep, and so he wants input on what's going on. Now, I don't know if you noticed this. He's very specific about what he wants. Nebuchadnezzar wants someone to come in and tell him what his dream was about. He wants his advisors to tell him the content of his own dream. Imagine trying this with your wife. You have a vivid dream. You wake up. Hey, honey, tell me what I just dreamt about. Like, good luck with that. Nobody can do that. And yet that's what he's demanding of his advisors. And so when they came in and stood before him, he said to them, I've had a dream that troubles me, and I want to know what it means. And the astrologers answered the king in Aramaic, O king, live forever. tell your servants the dream and we'll interpret it. And the, you know, standard procedure, like, let's do this. You tell us what you dreamt about, we'll tell you what it meant. We'll look up our books, we'll figure out what the correlation is. Well, the king's like, nah, that's not what we're going to do. This is what I firmly decided. If you don't tell me what my dream was and interpret it, I'm going to have you cut into pieces. Little baby Nebuchadnezzar temper tantrum here, right? I'm going to cut you, and your houses, they're going to be in piles of rubble. But if you tell me the dream and explain it, then this is the opposite extreme. You're going to receive gifts from me and rewards and great honor. So tell me the dream and interpret it for me. Now, at this point, you know, the advisors are probably looking at each other like, is this guy serious? He really wants us to do this? And yeah, the impossible command is you climb in my brain and tell me what I dreamt about. And of course, you know, they're just like, how about you tell us the dream? And then we'll explain it. And the king's like, no, I'm certain that you're trying to gain time because you realize that this is what I've firmly decided. If you don't tell me the dream, there's just one penalty for you, which he already laid out. You've conspired to tell me misleading and wicked things, hoping the situation will change. So then tell me the dream and I'll know that you can interpret it for me. Okay, now just kind of backing up here. How could Nebuchadnezzar know that their interpretation could be trusted? I mean, couldn't they just make it up? I mean, his logic is pretty sound. Like, if you can't tell me what I dreamt about, why should I assume you're in touch with the supernatural? If you're not in touch with a God out there, why should I trust your interpretation? You could just make anything up you want to. He's like, that will not do. You're going to convince me I should listen to your interpretation. You better prove that you know the supernatural and that you know what I dreamt about. And so I get the logic. Now, before I go any further, I just want to reflect a little bit about this whole scenario. Just one thing is, doesn't it seem like it's Nebuchadnezzar against the world? Like he doesn't trust anyone in the room? It's like, you guys, you're conspiring, you're misleading, you're wicked. And, you know, it really seems like he just feels like it's just him and he's got to protect himself. And this is one of these things when we strike out in rebellion against God, when we don't have the backing of a loving God, where we haven't brought him into our life and begun a relationship with him. It really is your wits against the people around you. We come in these situations like he's in at kind of a relational deficit. Instead of having a God who's going to meet our needs, we're kind of going in and looking to see, is this a safe place or am I going to have to protect myself? Am I going to get what I need out of this interaction? And you totally see this with Nebuchadnezzar. And imagine this is your work environment. You go into a meeting with your subordinates, and you can see in their eyes they're untrustworthy. You don't say it out loud like Nebuchadnezzar, but you're like, you guys want to kill me. This isn't just crazy thinking either with Nebuchadnezzar. Two of the three kings that followed in the Babylonian Empire were assassinated. The guy right after Nebuchadnezzar was killed by his brother-in-law. And two kings after that, the king was killed by his advisors and nobles. So this seems like paranoia, but it's with good reason. This is, you know, when you're laying in bed at night, thinking about what can happen, and you realize I don't have any true allies, that's a tough spot to be in. Cut into pieces, by the way, that's what Nebuchadnezzar decides to do. Is he's like, instead of being made to look like a fool by a fake interpretation, I'll strike first. If there is any sign of incompetence or deception, I'm going to destroy these people. That phrase, I'll cut you into pieces, they're being nice in the translation. It literally means, I will turn you into limbs. We know, we have records of how Nebuchadnezzar would execute people. This is from Gleason Archer. The victim's arms and legs would be tied to four powerful trees, one limb for each tree, roped together at the top, and when the ropes were cut, the victim, as these branches sprung out, would suddenly be dismembered, right, into four pieces. Yeah, that is a big baby tantrum right there. So this is a big deal. This is how he's dealing with that sense of being alone in the world with nobody behind him, a man rebelling against God. The other thing I think to realize about this, and it kind of comes, is there's something rotting at the core of Babylon. Nebuchadnezzar's worldview is showing some fault lines. His gods really didn't exist, like gods like Marduk or Nebo, they didn't exist. And his advisors were blind guides. I mean, all this is an admission. He doesn't have anybody he can go to for answers. As he's laying in bed at night, thinking about this dream, thinking about his future, it doesn't matter that he's the king of the greatest empire in the world. He's laying there with no answers, facing the darkness of this uncertain future, because this is the path he's on, a path of rebellion against God. And so, yeah, the astrologers are still pushing back. They're just like, nobody can do this. No king, however great and mighty, has ever asked such a thing of any magician or enchanter or astrologer. What the king is asking is too difficult. No one can reveal your dream to you except the gods, and they don't live among men. And what is that? That's just admitting we really aren't in touch with anybody that can help with this. Pretty sad state. And so this is the final straw. Nebuchadnezzar's like, he's so angry and furious, he orders the execution of all the wise men in Babylon. He's like, we're just going to destroy every... And this is, we have records of purges like this, where royalty would just completely obliterate the whole wise man class. So the decree was issued to put the wise men to death, and men were sent back to look for Daniel and his friends to put them to death. Oh, yeah. If you remember, Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they had just graduated to become full-blown wise men, just in time to, to be faced with this insane death sentence. Well, knowing that his own life is on the line, and you can tell he's concerned about all these wise men, Daniel decides, he keeps his head, he goes, it says, when Arioch, the commander of the king's guard, had gone out to put to death the wise men of Babylon, Daniel spoke to him with wisdom and tact. He asked the king's officer, why did the king issue such a harsh decree? He doesn't like say this is BS. He's just like, wow, that's pretty rough. And Arioch explains the matter. And so Daniel keeps his cool, tries to gather information, processes what's happening, and then he has the kahunas to go to the king and ask for time. Risky move, right? I don't know how he got away with this. We have to assume it must have been God that made the king say, okay, that's cool. And so, yeah. He asked for time that he might interpret the dream, and apparently Nebuchadnezzar said yes, because Daniel then returned to his house and explained the matter to his friends, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He urged them to plead for mercy from the God of heaven concerning this mystery so that he and his friends might not be executed with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. Now, I've been to some pretty bad prayer meetings. Pretty ho-hum, sleepy, long pauses, or someone's praying for 15 minutes. This was not that. This was some fervent prayer, okay? These guys are like, Lord, our lives are on the line here. We really, really, really need to know what Nebuchadnezzar dreams. A desperate prayer. Really hoping to get some help here. And then it says, unbelievably, or believably, I guess, during the night, the mystery was revealed to Daniel. Oh, man, how cool is this? Daniel prays God. He just explodes with gratitude. He says, "Praise be to the name of God forever and ever. Wisdom and power are his. He changes times and seasons. He sets up kings and deposes them. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to the discerning. He reveals deep and hidden things and knows what lies in darkness, and light dwells within him." And so, unlike Nebuchadnezzar, whose temper tantrum kind of reveals his bankrupt worldview, we see Daniel having faith in God that's just growing and growing and growing. He's so grateful. So grateful for what God has done. He describes God as changing times and seasons. Now, this really isn't about winter, spring, summer, and fall. This is really about how God, the God of Daniel, God of Israel, can shape the flow of historical events. That's what he's talking about. And he mentions, you know, he sets up kings and deposes them. You know, sure, Nebuchadnezzar's king. Nebuchadnezzar has great authority. Other kings have authority, but God is the one who lifts kings up and brings them down. You know, Daniel's sitting there as somebody who was kidnapped by Nebuchadnezzar and had his whole life turned upside down and is now in Babylon, completely removed away from his old culture. He's still able to say, you know, behind it all, God is totally in control. This is Daniel's God. And you've got to remember, as he's thanking and praising and extolling who God is, that Daniel's thinking about an audience. He's thinking about another audience, not Nebuchadnezzar. Who is Daniel writing this book to? He's writing this book to another group of rebels, his own countrymen, who have turned away from God. And he wants them to know, you know, listen to how just emphatic he is. "You, Lord, you gave me wisdom and power. You have made known to me what we asked of you. You've made known to us the dream." He's extolling God as the source of wisdom and power because these rebels, his fellow countrymen, are about to come out of exile. Having been in Babylon, as you go through this whole book, by the time this book is finished, the people of Israel are about to leave Babylon and come back to Israel, back to their land. And Daniel is pleading with them by extolling God like this. He's pleading with them, "Don't forget how awesome God is." And this is something rebels really need to hear. You know, the Israelites, if you remember, they were delivered from slavery in Egypt. God sustained them in the wilderness. He revealed himself to them on Mount Sinai, and he brought them into the land. God completely demonstrated his love and concern for the people of Israel, and even still, they abandoned him and turned to other gods, gods like the ones that Nebuchadnezzar worshipped. And yet, all the way through this, God pursues them. And Daniel's saying, the way back when you've rebelled against God is to remember how good he is. And I would just throw out, you know, if you're here and you've been following God maybe in the past, and you've been through a long season where you've drifted away from God, the way back is not beating yourself up and just, you know, just assuming God wants nothing to do with you. This is the way back. The way back is to remember how awesome your God is, how good he is, how God's worked through his people to try to love you and care for you. This is the path back for a rebel. It's to focus on the power and the wisdom and the goodness of God. That's what we see Daniel holding up. Well, now he has the goods, right? Daniel knows the dream. So he goes back to Arioch, whom the king had appointed to execute the wise men of Babylon, and he's like, "Don't do it. Take me to the king. I'll interpret his dream for him." Arioch took Daniel to the king at once and said, "I found a man among the exiles from Judah who can tell the king what his dream means." You can tell Arioch doesn't want to kill all these people. And the king's like, asked Daniel, also called Belteshazzar, are you able to tell me what I saw in my dream and interpret it? And Daniel replied, no. Okay, that's not a good start. All right, I'm Arioch. I'm like, dude, you just said you could do this, and you could have the king, and you now you can't. What are you doing? We're going to get killed here. Well, Daniel replied, no wise man, enchanter, magician, or diviner can explain for the king the mysteries asked about. However, there is a God in heaven. Whew. Okay, good landing, right? There is a God in heaven who reveals mysteries. He has shown King Nebuchadnezzar what will happen. You got to really listen to all this language. What's going to happen in days to come? Your dream and the visions that pass through your mind as you lay on your bed are these. As you were lying there, O king, your mind turned to things to come, and the revealer of mysteries showed you what is going to happen. Now, you have to just put yourself in Nebuchadnezzar's shoes. He has believed in gods who don't exist. He has been served by wise men who have no answers. And now, for the first time in his life, he is talking to a true wise man who is in touch with the living God. And he's about to get his mind blown. There is a God in heaven, Nebuchadnezzar. Now let me introduce you to him. You looked, O king, and there before you stood this large statue. I put a lot of work into this PowerPoint, by the way. I hope you're happy with this. Okay, you looked, O king, there before you stood a large statue, an enormous, dazzling statue, awesome in appearance. So King Nebuchadnezzar's like, he's listening. He's listening to Daniel describe a dream he's never shared with anyone. And Daniel starts out and it's like, I saw a statue. And Nebuchadnezzar's like, yeah, kind of leaning in, eyes open. Okay, what else? The head of the statue was made of pure gold. Its chest and arms of silver. Its belly and thighs of bronze. Its legs of iron. Its feet partly of iron and partly of clay. And Nebuchadnezzar's like, yeah, yeah, yeah. Just, he must have been awestruck. Just imagine, it's someone telling you your dream. This had to be awe-inspiring as he listened to this. And Daniel goes on, while you were watching, a rock was cut out, but not by human hands. Weird. Cut, but not by human hands. It struck the statue on its feet of iron and clay and smashed them. So yeah, there's this rock that just comes flying in. And I couldn't animate this part, but it pulverizes the statue and it just kind of blows away in the wind. And that's the dream. Then the iron, he says, and the clay, the bronze, the silver, the gold were broken into pieces at the same time. They became like chaff on the threshing floor in the summer. The wind swept them away without leaving a trace. So this rock utterly obliterates the statue, but the rock that struck the statue became this huge mountain and filled the whole earth. Wow. Crazy dream. Now, what does it mean? Well, this was not the spicy bean burrito we had the night before, right? Causing this dream. It really was something that the living God gave to Nebuchadnezzar, the rebel. Isn't that interesting? God was willing to reveal himself to Nebuchadnezzar despite his rebellion. Each component of the dream had and still has significance in the real world. You'll see as we go through this. Daniel offers an explanation, right? He doesn't just tell the king what he saw. He tells him what it meant. And so he says, this was the dream, and now we'll interpret it to the king. You, O king, are the king of kings. The God of heaven has given you dominion and power and might and glory. In your hands, he has placed mankind and the beasts of the field and the birds of the air. Wherever they live, he's made you ruler over them all. You, he says, are the head of gold. Okay, now that is super helpful as far as understanding the dream, because he's telling us the first statue part, the gold head, is Babylon. Nebuchadnezzar, and really broadly, the empire of Babylon that he represents. And that would suggest that as we move down the statue, the other statue parts also represent kingdoms. And it turns out that is the case. Daniel says, after you, another kingdom will rise, okay? A second kingdom inferior to yours. Now, if I'm Nebuchadnezzar, I'm raising an eyebrow at this point. What do you mean another kingdom after me? I thought my kingdom was it. Well, no. Just like any other king or any other empire, they rise and they fall. After Babylon, there will be a second kingdom, an inferior kingdom. Then a third kingdom of bronze will rule the whole earth. And notice, I just want to point out here, as we're moving down the statue from head to toe, we are moving forward in time, right? So one kingdom appears, it goes away, it's replaced by another kingdom, that goes away, and so on. And as that's happening, as we go from top to bottom, we're actually moving forward in time. That's really important to remember. Okay, and then after you, yeah, I get that third kingdom. So Babylon, gold, silver, bronze, just like the Olympics. And then finally, there will be a fourth kingdom. And he really geeks out on the fourth kingdom. Lots of detail here. Strong as iron, for iron breaks and smashes everything. And as iron breaks things to pieces, so it will crush and break all the others. Iron, yeah, this is, of the four metals here, it's definitely the strongest. And this language, breaking, smashing, crushing, breaking, it really does communicate just incredible strength. So at least at the beginning of this kingdom, the early part of this kingdom, it was incredibly strong. However, as we keep traveling down the legs to the feet, which he talks about, he says, just as you saw that the feet and toes were partly of baked clay and partly of iron, so this will be a divided kingdom, yet it will have some of the strength of iron in it, even as you saw iron mixed with clay. So yeah, unlike this beginning super strong phase of the kingdom, as you go all the way down to the extreme bottom of the statue, to the toes, it's divided. It's different. And it's interesting, too, he says, he talks more about the toes. As the toes are partly iron and partly clay, so this kingdom will be partly strong and brittle, so very different, not just totally strong. And just as you saw the iron mixed with the baked clay, so the people will be a mixture and will not remain united any more than iron mixes with clay. And look what he says here. In the time of those kings, the kings he's talking about, I think, are the toes. This maybe 10 kings, 10 kingdoms that are loosely united. He says, when they're alive, during their day, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom that'll never be destroyed, nor will it be left to another people. It's going to crush all those kingdoms and bring them to an end, but it will itself endure forever. This is the meaning of the vision of the rock that's cut out of a mountain, but not by human hands, a rock that broke the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, and the gold. Okay, so there are these four kingdoms, and then finally, God's eternal kingdom, this rock that's cut without hands, comes and just obliterates all the human kingdoms preceding it. So like that. Yeah, comes in like we've seen before. And so yeah, the rock, in addition to these four kingdoms, when it comes in at the end of history, all human kingdoms before it are destroyed, and God's eternal kingdom fills the earth. All right. Here's, if you're lost, Daniel's aware of that. He provides a summary. He says, the great God has shown the king what will take place in the future. The dream is true, and the interpretation is trustworthy. So, bottom level here, what is this dream? It is a visual picture of the flow of history, starting from Babylon and going all the way until the end of history when God establishes his eternal kingdom. It's really a timeline. That's really what it is. There's some gaps in here. We'll get into that later in this series. But yeah, this statue is a timeline of key empires rising and falling over the course of history till God's kingdom is set up. The time again goes forward as we go down the statue, And one thing I can add here, this is new, but it's totally provable, is that we can identify these kingdoms. Okay, we already saw that the first kingdom is Babylon. You, O king, are the head of gold. That's crystal clear. We can also establish that the second kingdom is Medo-Persia, not just because historically they came after Babylon, but because in chapter 5, God comes to Belshazzar, the final king of Babylon. Okay, listen to what God says to the last king of Babylon. He says, your kingdom has been divided and given over to the Medes and Persians. Okay, that is helpful. That is undeniable proof that in the book of Daniel, the empire that follows the Medes and Persians, that follows Babylon, is the Medes and Persians. After the last king of Babylon, the Medo-Persians came into power. All right, and then the third kingdom, we can also identify this. We know from Daniel that the third kingdom was Greece. Now, how do we know that? Well, in Daniel 8, there's this really crazy vision. It involves this shaggy goat flying across the earth with incredible speed. It has this one conspicuous horn, and it slams into this two-horned ram, just like totally tramples it and destroys it and defeats it. And you're like, what does this mean? Well, we don't have to wonder. In chapter 8, this angel tells Daniel, the ram that you saw with the two horns represents the kings of Media and Persia. Okay, the ram that's trampled, the ram that's defeated, that's the Medo-Persians. And the shaggy goat represents, the victorious shaggy goat represents the kingdom of Greece. It's in there. It's in there very explicitly. These collide, Greece wins, Greece displaces the Medo-Persian Empire. Now, I did a little outside research to confirm this, and according to the movie 300, great movie, yeah, the Greeks actually did defeat the Persians. This empire, if you want to look it up like in Wikipedia, the empire, the Medo-Persian Empire, I think it's called the Achaemenid Empire, something like that. But anyhow, yeah, this is all in there. This is not like controversial stuff. But what about that fourth kingdom? Well, what do you guys think? Babylon, Media, Persia, Greece, and what? Rome. Historically, there's no other possible candidate. Rome displaced the Greek Empire. It's interesting, too, you know, the way Daniel describes it, iron crushing and smashing all that oppose it. Even Rome's own people, like this is Plutarch, he was like, with iron, not with gold, Rome buys her freedom. It was that whole description of this fourth strong iron crushing empire, perfect description of the military might and power of the Roman Empire, for sure. I'd also point out, and it's too detailed to get into, but if we get to Daniel 11, which I hope we get to, he offers confirmation that the fourth kingdom is Rome. It's pretty cool. Yeah, there's this fleet of ships that comes and then basically intimidates and backs off a Greek ruler, and they're definitely Roman ships. So, anyhow, there you go. Daniel, with God's help, is able to see the future. Yeah, that's the thing, the statue. What we're supposed to get out of this, what Daniel's original readers are supposed to get is, you know what? God is the God of history. He does control the times and the seasons. You know, when Daniel wrote this, it was 36 BC. Centuries before the Greek and Roman empires. And yet he accurately predicted that there would be this sequence of events, that the Greek power, and then Rome would come in after them. The other thing that's I want to point out is, and this is one of these things where we've got to cover so much to help you appreciate this. We're just at the beginning. I think it's pretty incredible that he could see these empires rising centuries before it happened. But we're going to get into predictions, especially in Daniel 7, 8, 9, about future events that are so detailed and that we know have come true. The only explanation is that God's involved. And when we get there, you know, hopefully you'll be persuaded. I think it's incredible. There's nothing, I'm telling you, there is nothing like the kind of detailed, fulfilled prophecy that we see in Daniel anywhere in the world. I challenge you to find anything like this, even what we've just read here. And so, yeah, these detailed predictions that have come to pass, that's what we'll see as we keep going. But I just want to throw out, as we make the case, as the case gets stronger, that God is there, that there is a revealer of mysteries, a supernatural being who loves us and who's spoken into our world. As the case gets stronger, how are you going to respond? It's interesting to look at how Nebuchadnezzar responded. I mean, he had somebody tell him his dreams. Here's how he responds. He fell prostrate before Daniel and paid him honor in order that an offering and incense be presented to him. The king said to Daniel, "Surely your God is the God of gods and the Lord of kings and a revealer of mysteries, for you were able to reveal this mystery." And so it's clear, I mean, if you got a monarch, you know, prostrate before, he's impressed. That's evident. But as we keep going in this book, he is far from ending his rebellion. He is nowhere close to following God. Just look at this. Your God, Daniel, right? He's not embracing the true God yet. He's like, yeah, that's really cool. I see that. There's something special happening here, but he's not willing to throw in yet. And you'll see when we get to chapters 3 and 4, wow, full throttle rebellion. So God isn't done with this guy yet. But the thing to remember, and it should blow your mind as we keep going through this, even as Nebuchadnezzar keeps rebelling, God keeps pursuing him. And I just want to maybe just pause and get you to think about that, especially if you're not sure what to think about God. You know, the Bible's view is he is a revealer of mysteries. He knows everything about you. He knows things that you've said in public and whispered under your breath. He knows how you've treated people. He's seen you do things that nobody else knows about. He knows that about all of us. And knowing this, it's easy to think, well, I'm screwed. Anybody that knows the true dark heart I have would know there's no chance with me and God. But you're not darker than Nebuchadnezzar. You know, God loves each of us and never stops pursuing us. Look at this, look at the breadth of this promise. This is Paul writing to Timothy. He says, "This is good, and it pleases God our Savior, who wants everyone to be saved and understand the truth. For there is one God and one mediator who can reconcile God and humanity, the man Christ Jesus." He gave his life to purchase freedom, not just for the deserving, not just for the ethical, but for everyone. That's what he says. And so, yeah, it's true. We're culpable, and there are consequences. God cares about justice. It's possible you could spend an eternity apart from God, and there is something you need to be saved from. Absolutely true. But the God who's there, the living God, has sent his son Jesus to help you be reconciled with him. And Jesus accomplished this by giving his life. He actually offered his own life on the cross as a way of satisfying God's justice for sins, for wrongdoing that we've committed. And when we call out to Jesus and we ask him to forgive us, not because we deserve it, but receiving it as a gift, he'll do that. And he'll pursue you. God will pursue you and try to point you to his son your entire life, whether you turn to him or not. This is God's commitment. He wants to reach you with his love. And that's what we're going to see play out as we keep looking at the life of Nebuchadnezzar. So one last lesson here, I think, if you know Christ, I wonder if you share Daniel's concern for people far from God. You know, this is such an extreme example. Nebuchadnezzar ruined Daniel's life. Nebuchadnezzar tore him from his family, destroyed his home country, enslaved him and indoctrinated him and employed him. And, you know, you think about Daniel going to the king to offer an interpretation of a dream. You know what I would have wanted to do? Maybe bring some poison or a knife in my belt and avenge my country. But we don't see Daniel do that. We see Daniel loving a man who doesn't deserve it. Daniel wanting to see him come to know God. So different, man, from what we see today. You get on Facebook or you get online and you see people who follow Christ so angry about cultural trends that disturb them, where their anger is way greater than their concern for the people in the culture. That is not what we see. Daniel had everything to be angry about. And yet, out of love, he pursued this wicked man. And I just wonder, you know, can we ache to see someone who has a different political view than us come to God? Or somebody who's mistreated us, or doesn't respect us, or even ridiculed us, come to God? You know, this is our God. He pursues rebels. That's Jesus died for the people that nailed him to the cross, right? And so that's us. That's what it means to be a believer in Jesus, is to go pursue rebels, to partner with Jesus in trying to reach people that he died for. If we forget that, if we get so agitated about this or that cause or this or that thing, and we forget that this is our heart mission here, man, I worry for our church. And so we can't lose this. I hope you're willing to follow Daniel's example, because it's one hell of an example. Now, one ominous footnote at the end of this story. The king puts Daniel in a high position because of what an amazing job he did. He lavished many gifts on him. He made him ruler over the entire province of Babylon. Place him in charge of all of its wise men. Moreover, at Daniel's request, the king appointed Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So Daniel's like looking out for his dudes. He gets them jobs, and Daniel himself remains in the royal court. And so we see these Jewish refugees, these nobodies, get rocketed past all of the nobility into some of the highest positions in the Babylonian Empire. And you know what? That's not going to go over too well with the people watching this happen. And next week, there will be hell to pay. And we'll get into that when we study Daniel 3 and 4. So, okay. Yeah, God, I agree with Sharon. Just pray as we go through the week here that when we find our blood pressure rising, that you would check us and help us see people the way you do, God. And partner with you the way Daniel partnered with you. Amen.